National News.
Talk Africa. Hello, I'm Heidi Adams. Great to have you with me this week. What happens when upholding the rule of law conflicts with political support for a former head of state? South Africa's Jacob Zuma is behind bars. His supporters have taken to the streets in protest. How did the so-called Rainbow Nation get here? Zuma's jailing is sparking a high-stakes showdown in South African politics. Around the world, investigating, prosecuting, even jailing former presidents and prime ministers for corruption and other crimes isn't new. But is it worth it? And is it good for democracy? This week, we'll debate the risks and rewards. We'll have expert analysis and your opinion. Straight Talk Africa starts now. I remember covering Jacob Zuma's 2009 election campaign as a young reporter in South Africa. He was certain to win because he was a hero of the country's fight to abolish racial apartheid. In the run-up to the election, I was covering two storylines. One was about Zuma's spectacular rise from shepherd boy to the highest office in the land, and his ability to connect with ordinary South Africans longing to see a president who would be a champion for the poor. The other story was about Zuma's chronic legal troubles and why his critics likened him to a gangster who posed a serious threat to the country's political and economic stability. This week, I want to share that extraordinary timeline with you about South Africa's man of the people who went from poverty to the presidency to prison. Jacob Zuma's legal troubles begin in 2005. He is South Africa's deputy president and a revered figure inside the ruling African National Congress. But Zuma is also embroiled in a major scandal linked to a controversial 1999 government arms deal. He is charged with corruption for allegedly accepting bribes from a French weapons company. Zuma denies wrongdoing, but is fired by then-President Thabo Mbeki.
It would be best to release Honorable Jacob Zuma from his responsibilities.
That same year, Zuma is charged with raping an HIV-positive family friend. He pleads not guilty, claims the sex was consensual, and that he took a shower after intercourse to avoid contracting HIV from unprotected sex. In 2006, Zuma is acquitted of rape. His corruption charges are also dismissed in court. In 2007, after a bitter tussle with Mbeki, Zuma takes over the ANC. He is wildly popular among the party's rank and file. But the law comes for him again. Zuma is indicted on multiple counts of racketeering, money laundering, corruption, and fraud linked to the 1999 weapons deal. Things start to look up for Zuma in 2008. He is named one of Time's 100 most influential people. His political rival Thabo Mbeki is forced out of office, and a high court rules the corruption charges against Zuma are invalid. But in the run-up to the 2009 election, that high court ruling is overturned by the Supreme Court of Appeals. The ruling means Zuma's corruption prosecution can resume. Days before the election, prosecutors dropped the charges, citing political interference in the investigation. The ANC wins the 2009 election, and Jacob Zuma sweeps to power on a leftist brand of populism, vowing to fight corruption and lift many South Africans out of poverty. But early on, his presidency is clouded by personal and political controversy. Street protests erupt over government's lack of social service delivery. Then a warning from renowned anti-apartheid activist Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Hey, Mr. Zuma, you and your government don't represent me. You represent your own interests. And I'm warning you, I really am warning you, out of love. I am warning you like I warned the nationalists. I am warning you. One day, we will start praying for the defeat of the ANC government.
Despite Tutu's caution, the ANC clinches a victory at the polls in 2014, securing Zuma a second term as president. But the party sees its electoral support decline, especially in major cities. Then a new scandal erupts, this time over multi-million dollar so-called security upgrades at Zuma's private compound in Nkandla.
Take your seats.
In Parliament, the opposition calls for Zuma to be held to account.
When is he paying the money?
In 2016, South Africa's Constitutional Court orders the president to pay back state funds used for non-security improvements to his family home.
Visitor center, the amphitheater, the cattle crawl, the chicken run, and the swimming pool.
An official inquiry clears Zuma of wrongdoing, but he apologizes to the country and pays back the money. By now, Africa's most developed economy is in trouble. Unemployment spikes and protests break out over joblessness and unaffordable tertiary education. Inside the ruling party, Zuma's popularity fades. ANC supporters boo and heckle him in front of foreign dignitaries, including US President Barack Obama.
Thank you.
The events of 2017 appear to be the death knell for Zuma's presidency. South African journalists uncover a massive government corruption scandal. Leaked confidential emails suggest Zuma and his family have ties to the immensely wealthy Indian-born Gupta brothers, and that the Guptas use their influence to appoint cabinet ministers and benefit from government contracts. The scandal sparks nationwide protests and calls for Zuma to go. That same year, South Africa's Supreme Court of Appeals rules that the president's corruption charges from the 1999 arms deal should again be reinstated. Zuma's legal and political baggage is now too much for the ANC to ignore. In February 2018, he is forced from office by his own party and replaced by Cyril Ramaphosa as leader of the ANC and ultimately the country. South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority announces it will reinstate charges against Zuma, 16 counts of corruption, racketeering and money laundering. When Zuma defies a court order to appear before a special inquiry into his time in office, a judge issues a warrant for his arrest. After an unsuccessful legal fight, Zuma is sentenced to prison for contempt of court. At his rural homestead, he addresses followers, likening his treatment to apartheid-era tactics.
I'm not scared of going to jail for my beliefs. It will not be for the first time. I will be a prisoner of conscience.
Just minutes before midnight on July 7, 2021, comes the moment Jacob Zuma had fought for over a decade. He hands himself over to police to begin serving his 15 months behind bars. Now, Jacob Zuma's supporters want him released, and we've seen the images of deadly protests, vandalism, and looting in recent weeks. Now, to help us understand the current mood and atmosphere in the country, I spoke to Ziyanda Stierman. She's an independent policy researcher and author, and she joined me from Cape Town, South Africa. I began by asking Stierman how much of what we watched unfold in South Africa is really about Zuma.
So that's a really interesting question, and I think that the two, to a certain extent, go hand in hand. So I think that this was certainly something that was instigated by Zuma loyalists, and I think disgruntled, local politicians and officials who've been sidelined, in the fact that their faction is no longer in control of the ANC, whether at a provincial level or a national level. And so I think what we've seen is a lot of the looting and the violence being instigated, by those particular political actors. But also that it's gone much farther and wider than that. That I think that everything that's happened has really tapped into a pain, and desperation, of very poor South Africans who felt locked out of the economy, for a very long time. And this was all, of course, worsened, with the COVID-19 pandemic, and the fact that South Africa has had some of the hardest, and harshest lockdown regulations in the world, which again has meant that it's brought the informal economy especially to a standstill. So I think that the two sort of factors have really gone hand in hand, that there were significant political factors, and those sort of from within the ANC and bubbling out into the public, but also at the same time, a lot of people who felt like, this was their one sort of opportunity to rise up.
Now, Ziyanda, you say you are not surprised by what you are seeing in South Africa right now, and that this is sort of a perfect storm long in the making. What do you mean by that?
So I think that there are a multitude of factors, again, that have contributed to this. I think that the failing levels of service delivery, of government services, particularly to poor and working class people, have led to a point where there's even a wider gap between the haves and the have-nots than there has been in any other sort of point of time in South Africa's history. The country's GDP has also been on a steady downward decline. So, we're seeing lower levels of GDP, lower levels of economic growth, and all of this has really put pressure, on ordinary South Africans and whatever it is that they're able to earn at the end of the day, and kind of taking that home. And I think that how we've sort of gotten here, is a lot of ineptitude, both in governance, and not being able to roll out basic services to people, but also political infighting, for at least the past decade. That's made it even harder to sort of keep stability in terms of government governance, and therefore to, again, sort of keep the rollout of services, especially to those who need it most, in order to keep that stable. So we're at a point where so much in our politics and in our society, but also in our economy, have come to a point where they've really put stress on the peace and security of the country. And that's why we see the military back out on the streets, because the police are overwhelmed. And it's also part of the reason why we see the police being unable to respond, as there have been multiple years of police failings in terms of equipment being available to do their jobs, resources and training. This is the whole point of the legacy of apartheid not being dismantled. If we had spent, I think, more of the past 27 years in very concerted, very real efforts, to try and reverse historical injustices, we might not have gotten to this point. But when the politics of the day, when they come to a head in this way, it's always, always, always ordinary South Africans who suffer the most.
And of course, the ANC is Africa's oldest liberation movement. Can you describe for us the factionalism that people are talking about inside the party? And is there a connection between what's happening inside the ANC and what's happening outside on the streets?
Yeah. So there's a very deep connection, I think, between the sort of inside and outside. So within the party, there's the factionalism of those who are still loyal to President Zuma, but also particularly those who benefited the most from his patronage network, and the very sort of parasitic relationship between government and the Gupta brothers, and all of that and everything that brought. So you still have those groupings or group of people who didn't go away and who are sort of hoping to regroup and therefore regain control of the ANC, and then in that way regain control of all of the sort of economic might, I think that comes with that. And then you have, more of a reform faction, and that's led by President Cyril Ramaphosa. And they sort of found themselves in these pitch battles against individuals like, you know, the Secretary General of the ANC, Ace Magashule, and others who were deeply involved in a lot of scandals, really, that siphoned public money from, you know, infrastructure or from state-owned enterprises. And all of that ended up in officials' pockets. So you essentially have this internal kind of battle for where the ANC was 10 years ago to where it's trying to go and who it's trying to reform and become again, you know, at the moment and in the future. And essentially what has happened is that the higher kind of levels of politics and those fights have spilled out onto the streets. And that has also meant that, you know, other sort of smaller local politicians that were aligned to one side or the other, you know, feel like they might be on the outs and have really sort of gone on this coordinated effort to destabilize the country and to show Ramaphosa as being a weak leader, being a bad president. And so therefore, you know, somebody who shouldn't be in control of the ANC or of the country.
And, you know, over the years, there have been people implying that there could be an element of tribalism inside the ruling party. See how careful I am around that. But would you agree with that kind of assessment?
So I wouldn't necessarily say so. I think that, you know, the sort of broad layout of the factions has been, you know, completely sort of spread out across the various cultural and ethnic groups. So I'm not as necessarily worried, you know, about tribalism coming to the fore in this case. What I do see as being a strong undercurrent has also sort of become this idea that, you know, that Jacob Zuma was the only one who was fighting against so-called white monopoly capital. And what that white monopoly capital is sort of big business interests. And because of the fact that Ramaphosa is a billionaire, that, you know, that he represents exactly that. At the same time, there being, you know, undercurrents of xenophobia, and the fact that, you know, one faction protects South Africans and protects South Africans' jobs more than the other faction does. And that, in this case, being the Zuma faction versus the Ramaphosa faction. So I think that there's a lot happening underneath, the surface. And there may certainly be an element of tribalism or ethnic chauvinism, you know, on the part of some Zuma loyalists. But I can't imagine that sort of broad strokes what's happening.
And now for anyone looking towards the future of the ruling party and the future of the country, how would you describe the state of Cyril Ramaphosa's South Africa and Cyril Ramaphosa's ANC?
There's disunity, truly. There's, you know, disunity within the ANC. There are people who are obviously jostling for position. I think especially important to remember that we have an election coming up, a local government election. At this point, it's still set for October, but it has been recommended by a senior jurist that the election be postponed until the end of February, you know, because of COVID and because of other logistical challenges. I think we'll see over the next couple of weeks if that happens. But because of the fact that we have that all important, you know, election coming up and what that will mean again for, you know, factions and access to public funds and to money and to political power, there is disunity and there. You know, I don't think that we can discount that, you know, the Zuma faction might try something again. It may be more localized. I think that a lot of this, you know, this past week's violence and chaos backfired, you know, and really kind of, I think, showed people that there's a very selfish group of people who are willing to destroy livelihoods in order to protect their own interests. And I think that kind of brings me to a final point, which is a lot more hopeful in the sense that, you know, we saw in the days after the violence calmed down and order was restored to a certain point, tons of communities came out to help each other out, you know, to clean up, to make sure that older people had access to food, to make sure that, you know, areas that were running out of essential supplies were restocked with those supplies. So I think that this has been a great sort of inflection point for our society to understand that, you know, we can't keep going and we can't keep the country and the economy going when there's, a permanent underclass who feels disenfranchised from the country and who feels disinvested from the country's future. That certainly is something that has to change.
And that was independent policy researcher Zianda Stierman. She's the author of the book, Can We Be Safe? The Future of Policing in South Africa. Now, we asked you to weigh in on this subject, and wow, what a passionate response we received on social media. Our question was, what message do you think former South African President Jacob Zuma's imprisonment sends to the rest of Africa? And here's what some of you had to say. Ibrahim Anyaz from Ghana says it will not change anything about Africa. In Africa, citizens come out in numbers to support and defend known criminals. This attitude cannot correct anything. Colombo Rogers says African leaders should refrain from abusing public funds when in power because they will be answerable to the same when their time is over. Justin Curtis believes subjecting former presidents to the court will serve as a deterrent and reduce the culture of impunity across Africa. Clive Kay from Zambia says it appears people enjoy admiring President Zuma's lavish lifestyle, expensive cars and million-dollar estates while they stand in line just to buy a loaf of bread. Otherwise, why wouldn't they want Zuma to face the law and answer to the allegations against him? I think it's just like a comedy. Loot today, stand in line tomorrow. Bobby George Uma in Kenya says Zuma's imprisonment has and will open a new chapter in South African politics. Local politics will come of age and rights violations will be the order on various discussions and solution forums. Harold Kajila from Zambia says the message he sees is this: power must be managed in accordance with the Constitution. Do not abuse power. Dixon Mazunga says it depends on the depth of evidence available. Otherwise, the ruling parties or leaders use it as witch hunting or to persecute, humiliate and victimize former presidents. Stevens Kwame in Ghana says Zuma's jailing should send a strong message to the corrupt African leaders. However, in some countries, the constitution makes a former president untouchable, even though he or she was involved in corruption activities, which is very bad. Hashim Amadou Pabai in Sierra Leone says it should send a signal to everyone in Africa that no citizen of an African country is above the law and we should all work harder to uphold the rule of law. Zinzile Mtotiwa says, I doubt it is sending any message. That, of course, will be determined by the reaction of the voting masses in these and other countries. We thank you so much for all those comments. Of course, we had so many and we couldn't read all of them, but you can go to our Facebook page and read some more of those comments. But thank you for keeping the conversation going on social media. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, the risks and rewards of prosecuting a former president. Stay with us. Straight Talk Africa. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. That is former South African President Jacob Zuma there, rallying supporters shortly before handing himself over to police to start serving his 15-month prison sentence for contempt of court. He's singing his favorite revolutionary song, Awuletu Shiniwam, which translated from Zulu to English means, bring me my machine gun. Now, as we said earlier, the investigation, prosecution, even imprisonment of former presidents and prime ministers is nothing new. But is it worth it? And is it good for democracy? And that is the theme of my discussion with our guests. Gentlemen, so great to have you with me. Let's do a quick round of introductions here. Chris Maroleng is the Executive Director of Good Governance Africa, a research and advocacy organization. He joins us from Johannesburg, South Africa. And also with us from Seattle in the U.S. state of Washington is James Long, a professor of political science and the co-founder of the Political Economy Forum at the University of Washington. I'd like to welcome you both. Chris, I'm going to ask you to kick us off here. Help us understand the situation that South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa is in right now. I mean, how do you govern a country effectively when you have a predecessor or essentially a political rival who wields enormous influence, not just inside the ruling party, but out on the streets and from what we've seen in recent weeks, who are willing to raise hell in his defense? How does Ramaphosa navigate the situation?
The question that you ask is a very complex one, and it requires us maybe to start with a definitional understanding of what it is that we're looking at. So we're looking at, in essence, a breakdown in governance in South Africa. And what do I mean by governance? Basically, we have a simple definition at Good Governance Africa of what governance stands for. And it's basically about who gets what, when, and how. It is about the authoritative allocation of resources, and basically whether these resources are allocated in a transparent and accountable fashion, and in a fashion that is directed or in the interest of the citizen. Now, in South Africa, we have a very interesting process unfolding right now. We have deep inequality, long-standing poverty, and simply a situation where a president is required to govern where the playing field or the imbalances in society make it difficult for him to operate as what we would describe as more normalized societies. So it places a burden on President Cyril Ramaphosa to basically address these contending socioeconomic requirements and at the same time manage the internal political dynamics unfolding in his party. And this leads to a very complex dynamic where the president is being questioned about whether, in actual fact, the ANC, his party, and President Cyril Ramaphosa are in actual fact fit to govern.
And James, it does look like Joe Biden is in a near similar situation. And you know, I've got to smile sometimes when I see these similarities in the politics of the country that I'm from and the country that I now live in. Joe Biden's predecessor is, of course, not inside his party, but does wield outsized influence over members of Congress, governors, mayors, and a large swath of the electorate. What are Biden's options here?
Well, I hate to make the comparison to sound fatuous, but, you know, a lot of people say Jacob Zuma was Trump before Trump. And so I think the similarities are real. I think the real difference is precisely the fact that Biden, unlike Ramaphosa from the same party, from the same sort of government, Biden is in opposition party to the Republicans and is now governing. So I think that is one sort of pitfall for Biden, is he has to think about how he wants to approach this issue as someone who, you know, you could reasonably think obviously would have political motivations to want to try to prevent Trump from rising again and being reelected or running against him for whatever reason. But I also think that Biden's role in this might be somewhat limited, because right now I think really the legal questions that Trump is likely to face in the short term, if any, would be prosecutions at the state and local level. And there, Biden doesn't have any real influence over what happens. Biden would only have influence if there were federal charges brought against Trump or members of his inner circle, perhaps for the insurrection on January 6th or some other federal charge. But right now, I think Biden can sort of, you know, sit back and kind of let the process play itself out, which I think is both smart politically, but also important legally, that the president should not get involved in state or local prosecutions. But I do think the larger point of your question is, how does he just govern in the way that Chris defined, which I agree with? How does he govern a country where, you know, at least some proportion of the party that's out of power right now continues to support this leader? And I think the answer is it's very difficult. And I think a lot like what the ANC is, it's less a question of Biden and the Democrats or even the various branches of government. It's more a question for the Republican Party. And is the Republican Party going to continue to promote Trump and try to run him or candidates like him as a viable candidate in hopes of winning elections for political expediency? Or do they want to lance the boil and try to just move on and kind of go to a new place with new leaders? And I think it's really a question for the Republicans as much as it is for the Biden administration.
I just wanted to add on to basically what James was saying, and really what one of the ways to contextualize what's going on in South Africa is really a battle for the soul, previously, as we would say, as William Gumede nicely phrased it in his book, a battle for the soul of the ANC. But really what we're faced right now is an existential threat, which talks to a battle for the soul of governance, the rule of law, and constitutional democracy in South Africa. On the one hand, we have those who believe in the importance of the rule of law, democracy, and good governance. And these, like President Cyril Ramaphosa, are saying that even when we have a former head of state like former President Jacob Zuma, who faces serious allegations about malfeasance and corruption and has most recently been imprisoned for failure to comply with the constitutional order, basically means that what we're seeing in South Africa talks fundamentally to this question about the place of the rule of law in our society. And we have a former president who seems to operate and act in his statements and his articulation to his supporters that he seems to think that he's above the rule of law. And we in South Africa are saying, as we battle for the essential survival of a democratic, liberal South African dispensation, that this is very much what this is about. And as James has indicated to us, you know, it's interesting how some of these questions are about the rule of law and whether a president is above public scrutiny. And indeed, the law is something that was really front and center during the Trump administration.
James, in an article you co-authored recently, you say that at first glance, it does look like an obvious decision for a democracy to go after a president or prime minister accused of illegal conduct. But then you say it's not that simple. Why do you say that?
Yeah, the problem with democracy is it makes nothing simple. It tries to correct all the alternatives, and in so doing poses new dilemmas. So I think, you know, the obvious point is that rule of law is the foundation for any democracy. And we think of a democracy as being fundamentally about nobody is above the rule of law. Everyone should be held accountable, right? So it's not like a dictatorship, or it's not even like a monarch, you know, that, you know, somebody's been appointed by God or is just a dictator. And so they are in effect above the rule of law. But no, that a democracy is about everyone should be held accountable equally and subject to the rule of law. I think the problem is that most of the time we think the application of law against everyday citizens should be driven by considerations of law and not politics. You know, I'm just an everyday citizen. You know, if I were to commit a crime, you know, that wouldn't be a political act. But when it comes to a politician or a head of state or a member of the government, it's going to be fundamentally political no matter what. And so it's very difficult to then say that that we can just sort of equally and try to apply the law in these cases, because politicians are just play a different role and have different mandates. And in a lot of ways, they can be prosecuted for things that everyday citizens cannot be prosecuted for, precisely because they are elected officials or even appointed officials. And I think what has to happen in a democracy in thinking about going after former leaders for allegations of corruption is, on the one hand, having sweeping immunity would completely undermine the concept of the rule of law. On the other hand, the process becomes so political and there's overzealous prosecution and it's used as a political weapon, then law is undermined along a different dimension, which is precisely that it's only to go after certain types of people to remove them perhaps from the political space or the ability to run in the future. And so I think that's kind of the consideration that a country wants to think about, is like, is this about sweeping immunity and everybody is above the law? Is this about being too overzealous and using the law as a political weapon? But no matter what, and this is the problem and the issue in democracy, these prosecutions will have political dynamics no matter what.
Chris, what's your take? Because Jacob Zuma isn't just anyone, and all along he has said that these allegations and the charges against him are politically motivated.
He isn't just anyone, but I think as James indicates to us, what it really brings up, in at least in my imagination, is this question about the rule of law versus rule by law. Right? And what Jacob Zuma wants us to believe is that there is some kind of conspiracy where there's an attempt, at least by the judiciary and others, to remove him from office. This is far from the truth. In actual fact, what we're seeing in South Africa is a situation where the executive, the judiciary, and very much the legislature, affirming the principle that we are all equal under the law. And more importantly, if we believe in the rule of law, which is a central component of this liberal democracy that we believe South Africa should be following as enshrined in our constitutional provisions, in South Africa's constitution, which is quite progressive, by the way, we are seeing a situation where people like former President Jacob Zuma are rebelling against this concept of the rule of law. And what has it's resulted in is this narrative being created in our political space, which has resulted, unfortunately, in significant losses, both economically, socially, in terms of our social cohesion, where we saw people, to a large degree, being led to go out into the streets, to riot, to loot, ostensibly because of this conspiracy about rule by law and an attempt to usurp or impose the powers that the judiciary has over the executive. I think this is incorrect. And in actual fact, it's very important right now that we should state, not just for South Africa, but really for the African continent, and put it in its proper context and say what we are seeing playing out in South Africa really talks to the crucial arguments about the efficacy of democracy, the rule of law, and an affirmation that, in actual fact, we are all equal under the law.
Now, you know, James, you look at some countries like France and Israel, life seems to have gone on after this type of situation. Do all democracies ultimately survive the prosecution and even the jailing of a former leader? Or does it depend on the nature of the politician, the personality, the politics, or the people of that country?
That's a great question. And one of the things we try to do in the article that you referenced is to say that depending on where a country is in terms of its democratic health and maturity and institutionalization, prosecutions can work, and you're exactly right, life does go on. Jacques Chirac, the former president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy has been recently found guilty as well. Democracy will not die in France tomorrow, probably, and if it does, it will not be because Sarkozy would go to jail. Israel is a democracy. Bibi Netanyahu, his trial was going on both when he was prime minister as well as now that he has left office. South Korea has prosecuted former leaders, and democracy in South Korea is very strong. I think where it becomes an issue is when democracy is weak, when it hasn't consolidated. And at that point, it could really allow certain sides or factions to take to the streets in a way that is not healthy protest, but could actually destabilize the fundamental institutions of governance and potentially make democracy collapse. And so what I think is so interesting about South Africa is I can't think of a single other country around which people reasonably argue how healthy is its democracy. Yes, it's a leading light in Africa, but South Africans are often very critical of, you know, the degree to which the, if we were to go back to 1994, the degree to which all of that hope and opportunity has actually been realized. And so depending on who you compare South Africa to, South Africa either appears as a very healthy, strong, institutionalized democracy, certainly with challenges, or it appears as though, you know, perhaps it's not as strong as we think. And its institutions, you know, once you start to put pressure on some of them, it actually can crumble in a lot of areas. Or like Chris says, the failure of governance is a real threat there. And so I think, you know, South Africa might be sort of perfectly in the middle in a test case of in a country that does have rule of law, does have independent courts and judiciary, at the same time still has these enormous challenges with its institutions. Will it be able to survive? My guess would be yes. But I, you know, I'm not a South African expert, but I do think South Africa is going to be a really important test case, not only for Africa, but the rest of the world.
Chris, what's your take?
Absolutely. I think one of the key things that James raises for us is this concept that many in our country raise when we are faced with such existential questions around the presence and commitment towards democracy, which is that, in essence, you know, the people cannot eat the Constitution. That's what they say. We can't eat the Constitution. We can't eat the Bill of Rights, you know, and all of the things that it suggests with regards to our adherence to democratic norms. However, I actually argue against that, and I say that what is really at risk here, and what we are assessing in South Africa, is the strength of our institutions that safeguard our constitutional democracy. So these institutions ultimately really speak and breathe life into the Constitution by saying that, yes, we are all equal by equal before the law. They also say to us, in actual fact, that there is a deep need to address the structural issues in our society, deep inequality, poverty, in certain instances, insecurity. And these things talk about the strength of our institutions. Have we in South Africa created institutions that are strong enough to resist these strong and compelling arguments against constitutional democracy? And it's no surprise that we face these strong challenges to our democracy, because throughout Africa, in actual fact, right through the world, there are debates around the efficacy of democracy in and of itself and whether it makes sense, especially in South Africa and in Africa, where people are saying, you know, they would prefer efficient governance above democratic governance. Efficient governance that delivers services, that delivers a vibrant economy, that makes sure that everyone has got a job, people are educated, services are delivered. But we actually argue that it is not this false dichotomy that is presented, where on the one hand, efficient governance leads to the delivery of all of these services. But in actual fact, what we're saying is that it's a false dichotomy, because without good governance, without democracy, we cannot have a sustainable process of efficient governance that is not personalized around an individual, around a political party, around some kind of autocratic demagogue, even if it's a benevolent dictator, but one that talks to a transparent and accountable system of governance that has at its center the citizen. And this is what we're talking about in South Africa right now. That's why it talks centrally to this question around the strength of our institutions.
And how hard is it to hold a president or prime minister to account while he is in office? We see in the United States there seems to be an almost, you know, unspoken rule or hesitancy to hold a president accused of illegal conduct to account while he is in office. But then you look at places like South Africa and Israel, where leaders have been investigated and prosecuted while in office.
Well, I think kind of regardless of how you think about a particular president that has had allegations while they were in office, you know, we could look at Donald Trump, we could look at Richard Nixon, we could look at Bill Clinton. I think an honest argument about why this is potentially a problem is that because they are the head in the United States, they're both the head of state and head of government. They're the executive branch. They have to make decisions that if they are being investigated, they might otherwise be distracted from their constitutional duties to discharge their duties. You know, for instance, considering whether to go to war or other types of things, that this would be a distraction. So I think that's one of the hesitancies. And that's, I think, why the founders and the framers of the U.S. Constitution wanted to set a very, very high bar. But at the same time, and this is what we have to remember, the expectation of how these institutions would perform, as well as how individual presidents should perform in office, they also set a high bar. You know, so it's, you know, so if you're being distracted by your discharging your constitutional duties, but it's because you've misbehaved, well, that's on you. You know, that's not the fault of the institutions. And so there's this kind of push and pull where we both believe and it is important for them to be able to do their duties and concentrate on that. At the same time, if there's allegations against them and they're assuming they're credible, that's their fault. You know, that's because they did, you know, potentially did something wrong. And so I think that balance is there. The other reason that it's, I think, very disturbing in the United States is, you know, during impeachment processes, it does create a lack of clarity and stability in the short term about who exactly is in charge, what might happen. And I think there's always kind of a national security consideration that the United States would never want to appear weak to the outside if there's just a lack of clarity about who's really in charge or things are unstable. I would counter that by saying the problem is that if the president in charge is destabilizing the system so much, and that sort of raises a lot of questions about who's in charge as well. So, you know, it really depends on the context and the situation. But I think, you know, those are some reasons why there's always a hesitancy to go after people while they're in office.
And I'll have more from my discussion with Chris Maroleng and James Long after the break. We'll also have the results of our social media poll in which we asked you whether investigating former leaders is good for democracy. This is Straight Talk Africa. We'll be right back. You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. We're talking about criminally investigating and prosecuting and in some cases even jailing former presidents and prime ministers. Is it good for a country? Is it worth it? Now, we conducted a poll on social media and asked you whether investigating former leaders is good for democracy. And here are the results of our poll. 86% of you said yes and 14% said no. Thank you so much for participating in our poll. We're going to try and do some more of these in coming weeks, but it was great to get your input. Now, we continue our discussion with Chris Maroleng, the Executive Director of Good Governance Africa, and James Long, a professor and co-founder of the Political Economy Forum at the University of Washington. Next, we discuss the political implications of pardoning former presidents. Chris, Cyril Ramaphosa is also under pressure from some quarters to pardon Zuma. What are his options? He has to preside now over lots of tension and division inside the party. Would pardoning Zuma be a political lifeline for Ramaphosa or political suicide?
I think it would be political suicide because we come from a very checkered history, as you know. What you face in South Africa is a country that has experienced and its citizens have experienced what you could describe not just as a lack of justice, but as a lack of social justice, where in actual fact, in reality, they were first-class citizens and they were second-class citizens. Not all were equal before the law. And in actual fact, what you saw was a regime during the apartheid dispensation that really ruled and presided over South Africa, having committed serious crimes against humanity, right? And a situation where we saw the creation, the potential creation of impunity as characterizing the political landscape. And now you have President Cyril Ramaphosa, who is faced with this situation where some are calling for him to pardon President Jacob Zuma for alleged crimes related to corruption and other malfeasance. I think it would be wrong for President Cyril Ramaphosa to do so because, in essence, by doing so, he extends this concept of impunity and this imbalance in society that is really focused on the lack of social justice. Justice says that we are equal before the law. that the rule of law applies to all of us, irrespective of whether you're a former president, a sitting head of state or president in South Africa, and that we as South Africans, as part of our commitment to good governance, building strong institutions for the future, do not accept a situation where a former head of state can count on a simple thing like a presidential pardon from, remember, his counterpart from the same political party, which is very much akin to what happened during the apartheid dispensation. So, no, I say that President Cyril Ramaphosa would be very remiss in order if he did accord President Jacob Zuma a pardon, because it goes against the very fabric of our constitution and the founding principles of the new democratic South Africa.
James, this takes us back to 1970s American politics when Gerald Ford famously pardoned Richard Nixon, saying it would just be too divisive to punish him. And that arguably lost him the election. Are pardons like this political suicide for any leader?
I think it's a question of, you know, for whom are they political suicide? I think so Ford did sort of issue a blanket pardon for Nixon, and Ford did lose then the next election in 1976. But the Republicans came back in 1980 and then won the next three presidential elections. And so there's a kind of an interesting short term versus long term. And this is what I was saying earlier is, you know, the short term calculation can be, look, it's better for us to move on. It's better for the Republican Party to move on in the case of Nixon or Trump. So, you know, whether that means a pardon or a prosecution, let's just try to move on as best as possible versus, no, let's not do that. Let's let the process play itself out. If these people are innocent or they're not going to be found guilty, even if it's years and years of trial, then that's what it takes, you know, and if that increases the likelihood that other aspects of this process will be traumatic to society, well, that's the price we pay to live in a democracy that is trying to exert rule of law. So I think it's a big question. So I think in a weird way, Gerald Ford's pardon was bad for him personally, but I think really helped strengthen the Republican Party and give them the ability to move on. And, you know, what's interesting about Ramaphosa with the ANC is, regardless of what happens to Zuma, the ANC is still in power. And so the internal conversations are within these parties about how they want to be perceived in the future, above and beyond any one particular leader at one time, I think is always a huge consideration. And sometimes people sort of cannibalize the party and try to make it in their image, but other times people sort of have a mind towards, you know, the party is bigger and better than just me, and so I have to think about how is our party going to be viewed longer term. And so I think in a weird way, again, Ford hurt himself in the short term, but actually helped the Republicans in the long term.
Chris, you tell me, how closely are other African leaders watching the situation in South Africa? I mean, here is an African country upholding its own rule of law, with a former president behind bars, not in The Hague, but at home. Do you worry this sends a message to others who might be accused of corruption or war crimes, that the only way to stay out of prison is to stay in power?
Indeed. I think you ask another fundamental question about what are the messages that we are sending to our counterparts in the rest of the continent. And I think the message that we should or should be received, at least in the various capitals of Africa, is that impunity is unacceptable. And ultimately, if we talk of democracy, it cannot just refer to regular elections. But it must really refer to the creation of an institutional structure that talks to a rules-based and rights-based system in Africa that really says that no one is above the law. Even if you are the head of state of an African country right now, I think the message should be clearly articulated that as much as you may have popular support, if you really are committed to democracy, that popular support should really be focused on ensuring that that populism does not lead to some kind of autocratic regime of a personality cult, but that populism should be added to this call, increasing call in Africa, that says that we are all equal to the law. rule of law is important, and ultimately democracy is more than just regular elections. It's really about values and principles that underline this and that are found in the constitutions of many African countries. So it's an exciting time to be in Africa, because hopefully we are beginning to see the emergence, hopefully with South Africa at the forefront of this, of an emerging wave of democratization, redemocratization of Africa, that talks about the strength of institutionalized democracies in Africa.
And James, what do you think about the message here, not only for other African nations, but for other nations around the world, that power can protect you from prison?
That is certainly a concern, I think. But I think what I think is, you know, wonderful. It may not, it's traumatic for South Africa right now, and I understand that. But I think it's wonderful that it's happening in South Africa. It's, for better or worse, and whether South Africans want this to be true, it is true that the rest of the world, particularly Africa and the developing world, see South Africa as sort of what to aspire to in a lot of ways, at least in terms of its constitutionalism and the institutions of government. But I also think there's a lot of hope to be found in the current crisis. I think a lot of times when we stress institutions, when we sort of kick the tires on various aspects of a system, yes, we reveal weaknesses, but that allows us to then target, okay, this is a place for strengthening. This is a place that we previously didn't know was potentially weak that needs to be strengthened. And so, you know, we could look at even the fact that the ANC was able to get Zuma to step down shows that the ANC at some level actually is bigger than any one person, is bigger than this personality cult. While the protests and the violence and the riots right now are very tragic in South Africa, they're doing exactly what Chris said, which is revealing the deep dissatisfaction that many people have with the lack of services, with the perception of impunity, with, you know, the inability, you know, the frustration about COVID lockdowns, the inability of the vaccine rollout to happen in such a way, as well as potentially also perhaps revealing some weaknesses within the police and within security organs that are either, easily influenced by nefarious actors or not equipped to provide the security that they should. And so in the moment, we always think, oh, this is a bad thing. But I always try to look at it as a glass half full and say, but no, but now we know where we have to improve. Now we know going forward where we have to invest. And the last thing I will say is, I think one of the things that is happening, and it's happened before in South Africa, is we are seeing how important it is for a judiciary to be independent of the executive branch. And if I were to say that's the big takeaway for other countries, it's to try to get the judicial branch and the judiciary as separated from the political branches that are elected, like the like a president or the legislature, and that will be the great, you know, that will hopefully be the sort of great, strong, democratic institutional message coming out of South Africa, if that continues to be true.
Gentlemen, this has been quite the insightful conversation. We are going to leave it there. James Long is the co-founder of the Political Economy Forum at the University of Washington in the U.S. and Chris Maroleng is the executive director of Good Governance Africa. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Join me on the next Straight Talk Africa. As countries worldwide work to get shots in arms, many are running into a problem of trust and vaccine hesitancy. Is fake news to blame? And is misinformation on social media hurting vaccination drives across Africa? We'll speak to Ugandan Dr. Joachim Chikomeko, also a professional fact checker, as well as a data journalist, to help us separate medical facts from fiction. Also, shutdowns, showdowns, and crackdowns. We'll look at the power struggle between big tech and politicians. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is our show this week. Please remember, let's keep this conversation going on social media. You can find more news as well, more in-depth stories on the VOA News website. You can also download the VOA app. So whether you're joining us from across the African continent or elsewhere in the world, thank you for always watching and always listening. I'll see you next week. Goodbye.